If Washington's arrival gladdened James Madison's heart and reassured him that the greatest man in America would be at the convention to add the imprimatur of his presence, then he was only slightly less happy when, on May 15th, Edmund Randolph arrived in Philadelphia. The ancestry of the Randolphs, like so many of the Tidewater aristocracy, stretched back to 1643 and had intermarried with the Jeffersons, founded the College of William and Mary, and generated various governors, members of the Governor's Council, and members of the House of Burgesses. Edmund Randolph's uncle, Peyton Randolph, had been a president of the Continental Congress. His father, John Randolph, was a man of literary tastes, a skeptic in religion, and not much inclined to politics. But he was also Virginia's king's attorney, who, despite Patrick Henry's ungainly figure and address, recommended Henry's admission to the bar. Edmund Randolph was his father's only son, born in 1753, and at his father's Williamsburg home, he was introduced to everyone in Virginia society worth being introduced to. Washington, Jefferson, Richard Henry Lee, George Wythe. As a matter of natural course, he went to William and Mary, and just as naturally, he read law with his father to become an attorney himself. The Revolution, however, was a bolt of destruction to the Randolphs. The father, John, regarded his oath of service to the crown as binding on him and left for England in 1775, never to return, except to be buried in Virginia at his request after his death in 1784. The son, Edmund, felt keenly the shadow of suspicion which fell over him, and in August he personally volunteered himself to Washington as a staff member. But Edmund Randolph was more than equal to redeeming the deficits made by his father's Toryism. He had all the accomplishments of the scholar and the statesman, and he supported them with a force of eloquence and reasoning that did him great honor. His eloquence, most harmonious voice, fine person, and striking manners dispelled any lingering doubts. And he was soon enough recalled to Virginia to serve as a delegate to the Virginia Convention of 1776. And he was elected Attorney General under the new state constitution, and then to the Continental and Confederation Congresses, where he formed a close attachment to Madison. Like Madison, Randolph was convinced that the inability of the Confederation to fund itself would sooner or later ensure that the foundations of our independence will be laid in injustice and dishonor, and that the advantages of the Revolution, dependent upon the Federal Compact, will be of short duration. Randolph would soon be in a position to do something about it. On January 21, 1786, he was appointed by the Virginia Assembly to head the Virginia delegation to the Annapolis Conference. And the following November, he was elected governor of Virginia. Washington was delighted at his old staffer's elevation to the governor's mansion. Our affairs seem to be drawing to an awful crisis. It is necessary, therefore, that the abilities of every man should be drawn into action in a public line to rescue them, if possible, from impending ruin. And, Washington continued, since no one seems more fully impressed with the necessity of adopting such measures than yourself, so none is better qualified to be entrusted with the reins of government. In December, Randolph was one of the five Virginians dispatched to Philadelphia. Like Madison, again, Randolph had already been thinking ahead toward the likeliest results of the convention. Although, as he told Madison in March of 1787, he feared that resistance to any substantial change from dynamos like Patrick Henry would mean that the alterations should be grafted on the Articles of Confederation, the proposals he eventually wrote out were anything but mere band-aids. Randolph had had enough of a confederation where the states behaved as though they were independent powers. There must be, he said, a new compact in which the people themselves are the sole parties and which they alone can abrogate, delineating the degree to which they have parted with legislative, executive, and judicial power, as well as describing how far each of the simple forms of government is to be pursued in acts of legislation. Any new form of government, Randolph wrote, should have the following: a preamble, briefly to declare that the present federal government is insufficient to the general happiness, that the conviction of this fact gave birth to this convention, and that the only effectual mode which they can devise for curing this inefficiency is the establishment of a supreme legislative, executive, and judiciary. Second, a new form of government should make the declaration that the supreme legislative, executive, and judiciary shall be established, and that these departments shall be distinct and independent of each other. Third, this supreme legislative body shall consist of two branches, a House of Delegates and a Senate. And at the end, Randolph added what turned out to be a highly perceptive requirement: the ratification of the reform is to be made by a special convention in each state, to be chosen for the express purpose of considering and approving or repealing it in toto. Whatever came out of the convention, Randolph wanted to take no chances that a jealous Confederation Congress or truculent state legislatures would strangle it in its cradle. The new frame of government would go before the special conventions in each of the states, outflanking both the Confederation Congress and the state legislatures. And it would have to be taken as a single piece, not picked to death by special interests. This was all music to Madison's ears, and when the last member of the Virginia delegation, George Mason, arrived on May 17th, the entire delegation began caucusing with the Pennsylvania delegation on the direction they wanted the convention to take once a quorum of seven state delegations was in hand. And to Madison's relief, they did continue to arrive. Two of the South Carolinians, the forbidding trial lawyer and wartime governor, John Rutledge, and Charles Pinckney, the younger cousin of the formidable Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, also made it to Philadelphia on May 17th, followed over the next week by Pierce Butler and the mighty Charles Cotesworth Pinckney himself. Still, only four state delegations were on hand by May 20th, and it took five more days till May 25th before the necessary minimum of seven state delegations were ready to assemble. The expectations and hopes of all the Union center in this convention, George Mason wrote to his son. God grant that we may be able to concert effectual means of preserving our country from the evils which threaten us. The Pennsylvania legislature had put at the convention's disposal the old assembly room of the Pennsylvania State House, what we now call Independence Hall, on Chestnut Street, between 5th and 6th Streets in Philadelphia. It was the same room, significantly, in which the Declaration of Independence had been adopted almost 11 years before. In addition to the Pennsylvania, Virginia, and South Carolina delegations, four of North Carolina's delegates were now on hand. Two of New York's three delegates had arrived, including Alexander Hamilton, along with three of New Jersey's, two of Delaware's, and only one of Massachusetts' four delegates. Connecticut's delegates were on their way, as were Georgia's, although two of the three Georgia delegates would not arrive until June 11th. Rhode Island had stubbornly folded its arms and refused to participate. Of the 55 men who had been designated to represent their states at the convention, only 33 would attend all the sessions of the convention until its close with any consistency. The oldest of them, at 81, was Benjamin Franklin. But the single largest age block were men like Madison, Hamilton, and Randolph in their 30s. 29 of them were college educated, 9 alone from Princeton. An equal number were lawyers, although less than half of them actually practiced law as a source of income. 14 were merchants. 10, like Robert Morris, were involved in banking or lending. They were men of means, but with the exception of the financial types like Morris, not enormous wealth. And even then, the wealth often papered over deep wells of debt. 25 of the delegates owned slaves, and some actually brought slaves with them to Philadelphia. George Mason had a carriage driver and a valet. Madison, likewise, brought a valet with him. 8 of the delegates had signed the Declaration of Independence. 42 had been, at one time or other, members of the Continental Congress or the Confederation Congress. 2 delegates from Connecticut and Maryland never actually put in an appearance. There was no sense in which these men were intended to be somehow representative of the people of the United States. They were, for one thing, there to represent the interests of the states which had sent them, not the people at large or even on average. Some of them, like Caleb Strong from Northampton, Massachusetts, were fairly influential in their own way at home, but cut no particularly dashing figure on the national stage. William Pierce, who arrived at the end of May as part of the Georgia delegation, left a series of character sketches of many of the delegates, and he was unusually laconic in his description of Caleb Strong. A lawyer of some eminence, but as a speaker he is feeble and without confidence. Strong was, at least, fair-minded. John Adams would later pay him the tribute of being on a par with Washington in even-handedness in dealing with people. William Livingston of New Jersey struck Pierce as being a man of the first-rate talents, but he is no orator and seems little acquainted with the guiles of policy. That was not true of Livingston's fellow delegate from New Jersey, William Patterson, who was Irish-born, a graduate of Princeton, and a genial and soft-spoken lawyer. Patterson's long-beaked nose and receding chin and forehead, said Pierce, bespoke talents of no great extent, but in fact, he is very happy in the choice and time and manner of engaging in a debate and never speaks but when he understands his subject well. New York had sent a surprisingly feeble delegation. John Lansing was the mayor of Albany and a lawyer, but his legal knowledge, said Pierce, is not extensive, nor his education a good one, and he grew opposed to any proposal to junk the articles, so much so that he and his fellow New York delegate, Robert Yates, actually departed the convention in protest after a little more than a month. The joint letter they wrote to New York Governor George Clinton announced that a general government, however guarded by declarations of rights or cautionary provisions, must unavoidably, in a short time, be productive of the destruction of the civil liberty of such citizens who could be effectually coerced by it. And so, deciding that our further attendance would be fruitless and unavailing, they left. That left the representation of New York in the hands of one man who was more than equal to the task of taking up Yates and Lansing's slack, and that was Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton arrived in Philadelphia on May 25th, and he immediately impressed William Pierce as a finished scholar, able, convincing, and engaging in his eloquence the heart and head. He was not, said Pierce, a forceful speaker. There is something too feeble in his voice to be equal to the strains of oratory. What jarred Pierce was Hamilton's self-confidence bordering on arrogance. His manners, said Pierce, are tinctured with stiffness and sometimes with a degree of vanity that is highly disagreeable. The truth was, people either adored or hated Hamilton. And those who hated him hated with a perfect passion. George Clinton, the New York governor to whom Yates and Lansing so confidently addressed themselves, used the New York Journal as his political mouthpiece. And in it, the New York Journal spewed invective all over Hamilton as Tom Shit, an upstart attorney who had wormed his way into the confidence of a great and good man, namely Washington. Hamilton was, snarled the New York Journal in verse, from his own dunghill lately sprung, so buxom, debonair, and young, stranger to merit, genius, sense, he owes his rise to impudence, with strutting self-importance fraught, free from each particle of thought. To the glass he often goes, there adjusts his stock and clothes, meets his image with a glance of the sweetest complaisance. He's first, and oft the only one, to laugh at his own jest or pun. At the same time, though, Hamilton awed others. James Kent, a 24-year-old graduate of Yale and the future author of the most influential commentaries on American law ever written, described Hamilton as ingenious and political research not inferior to Gibbon, Hume, or Montesquieu. No one, however, left a more colorful or rakish stamp on the convention than the Pennsylvanian Gouverneur Morris. Born in New York, Morris had moved to Philadelphia in 1779 and had served in the Continental Congress. He was over 6 feet tall, had a saber-sharp wit, and a hauteur that could freeze fire. He was also a ladies' man of the most daring order. This was despite the loss of his left leg to amputation when he was crushed in a carriage accident in 1780. He walked with a wooden prosthetic attached below his knee. He became Robert Morris's assistant and protege as the Confederation's financial officer. Although they shared the same last name, they were not related. William Pierce rated Morris as one of those geniuses in whom every species of talents combine to render him conspicuous and flourishing in public debate. He winds through all the mazes of rhetoric and throws around him such a glare that he charms, captivates, and leads away the senses of all who hear him. With an infinite stretch of fancy, he brings to view things when he is engaged in deep argumentation that render all the labor of reasoning easy and pleasing. He has gone through a very extensive course of reading and is acquainted with all the sciences. No man has more wit, nor can anyone engage the attention more than Mr. Morris. Like his mentor, Gouverneur Morris was impatient of the financial weakness of the Confederation, only he was much less guarded in his expressions of contempt for it. Gouverneur Morris's speech was a very extravagant one, Madison said years later. It displayed his usual talent and also, in a striking degree, his usual fondness for saying things and advancing doctrines that no one else would. There was, in fact, no chance that Gouverneur Morris was not willing to take, especially with women. "I'm a busy man," he wrote to John Jay, "though, as heretofore, a pleasurable one." But he never took a greater chance than the one he took at a dinner party that included George Washington in 1784, when he bet Alexander Hamilton that a liberty could be taken with Washington. In the midst of their hilarity at dinner, Morris reached over suddenly toward Washington, next to whom he was seated, and clapping him on the back, shouted cheerfully, "Wasn't it so, my old boy?" Washington sat unmoved, and a death-like silence fell upon the whole company. Yet Washington seems never to have held the incident against Morris. "Mr. Morris is a man of superior talents," Washington wrote in 1789. "But his imagination sometimes runs ahead of his judgment, and immoral and loose expressions had created opinions that were not favorable to him, and which he did not merit." Thus, the members of a constitutional convention came together, representing a very different stratum of American society than the one they could see around them in Philadelphia, or would have noticed from their coach windows as they rattled uncomfortably toward the convention. Even the numbers of the convention's delegates effectively meant that there would be only one delegate in the convention for every 71,000 Americans. Or even worse, if we count only those delegates who sat consistently through the whole convention, one for every 118,000 Americans. Still, when the delegates finally convened in the assembly room, with its 14 large tables, including the table on which the Declaration of Independence had been signed, for its first working session on a rainy Friday, May 25th, 1787, no one expressed any hesitations about the authority with which they proposed to act. Looking from the entrance door of the assembly room, straight ahead to the raised dais along the back wall of the assembly room, the delegations sorted themselves out with a fine disregard to geography. South Carolina and Georgia sat at the two tables furthest to the right. Then, two tables for North Carolina and Maryland. And finally, three tables for Delaware, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. And no one would miss the significance of Pennsylvania and Virginia sitting in such close proximity. Glancing to the left would be tables for New Jersey and Connecticut, then New York and Massachusetts, and finally, New Hampshire, whose delegates would not arrive until late July because the state legislature refused to guarantee their expenses. A vacant table sat next to New Hampshire's for Rhode Island. There was also a table to the left of the dais, where it was presumed the secretary of the convention would sit, and another on the dais itself for whomever would serve as president of the convention. The issue of the presidency of the convention was taken by Robert Morris and the Pennsylvania delegation as the first trick, and they were determined that it should be won by George Washington. Originally, the plan had been for Benjamin Franklin to make the nomination of Washington. And since Franklin was the only other American who had a hope of rivaling Washington in stature, that ought to have settled the matter. But Franklin's gout was acting up and kept him within doors at his house on Market Street. And so it was Robert Morris who was on his feet, and by the instruction and in behalf of the deputation of Pennsylvania, he proposed George Washington, Esquire, late commander-in-chief, for president of the convention. Morris was at once seconded by John Rutledge of South Carolina, who hoped that the choice would be unanimous. It would be difficult to imagine any American rising to object to Washington, much less to propose an alternative candidate. And so Washington was unanimously elected and conducted to the chair on the dais by Morris and Rutledge. The convention would then need to select a secretary. And since the secretary need not be an actual delegate, and perhaps as a gracious nod in old Franklin's direction, James Wilson made another Pennsylvania nomination, this time of Temple Franklin, the old leather apron printer's grandson. This time, though, there was a competitor, 28-year-old Major William Jackson, who was one of the inner ring of Washington's old staff. He'd made no secret of wanting the job as secretary, and Alexander Hamilton, who was the most prominent member of that inner ring, popped up to nominate Jackson instead. The tables began to buzz, and in short order, the vote came out 5-2 among the seven delegations for Jackson. Temple Franklin might be the grandson of the greatest philosopher of the present age, But he also had an unendearing reputation as a prodigious goofball and show-off. Alas, William Jackson turned out to be but a poor secretary. He did little more than make brief jottings rather than keeping an exhaustive journal. And when the publication of the convention's proceedings was called for in 1818, the then Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, complained that Jackson's papers were very loosely and imperfectly kept, sometimes nothing but loose sheets of yeas and nays. Not that, in the long run, it would matter, because without asking the permission of anyone in particular, James Madison had pulled up a chair at the Secretary's table, rather than at the Virginia table, a seat in front of the presiding member with other members on my right and left hands. There, in no capacity except his own self-appointed one, Madison proceeded to take, day in and day out, meticulous notes on the convention's proceedings, notes which he would not allow in print until after his death, so that no one could easily challenge his claim that, in this favorable position for hearing all that passed, I noted, in terms legible, and in abbreviations and marks intelligible to myself, what was read from the chair or spoken by the members. And losing not a moment, unnecessarily, between the adjournment and reassembling of the convention, I was enabled to write out my daily notes every evening. There was one other item of business, and that was to create a rules committee. Once again, safely confided to the hands of Hamilton, the South Carolinian Charles Pinckney, and the Virginian George Wythe. In fact, there was only one sour note to disturb the entire first day's proceedings. As the credentials of each of the state delegations was officially read into the record, George Read of Delaware added the proviso that the Delaware legislature had tacked on to the credentials that those from Delaware were prohibited from changing the article in the Confederation establishing an equality of votes among the states. Reed did not mind revising the articles to award stronger powers to Congress, but he did not want his little state, with only 60,000 people, to lose the equal standing it had with every other state in the Confederation Congress. I conceive our existence as a state will depend upon our preserving the fifth article of the present Confederation, which gives each state one vote in determining questions in Congress. Reed had written to his fellow delegate from Delaware, John Dickinson, the original architect of the Articles of Confederation, "Such is my jealousy of most of the larger states that I would trust nothing to their candor, generosity, or ideas of public justice in behalf of this state." Madison, Morris, and Washington might have won the brief first round of the convention, but Reed's words were an ominous reminder that the way ahead was liable to be filled with longer and more difficult rounds. And they all agreed the man to take the point in facing those challenges was Edmund Randolph.